Blog Talk Radio.
Coming up next on The Big Show, from Saw 6, director Kevin Grudert, and from the new horror film Forget Me Not, writer-producer-director Tyler Oliver and writer-producer Jameson Stern, all the latest movie news and reviews, and our movie song of the week coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United, everybody. I hope everybody out there has had a great weekend. I know a lot of people out there that are listening are very excited about our first guest tonight, who is the director of the upcoming Saw film, Saw 6. His name is Kevin Grudert, and he'll be joining us in just a second. Just to let you guys know, Mr. Grudert has also previously edited the first five Saw films, and he finally gets his shot behind the director's chair on this. He also edited a great horror film from last year called The Strangers that was one of my favorite films of last year. Also on the show tonight, another terrific new horror film. It's going to premiere this year at Scream Fest LA. It's called Forget Me Not. And that writer, producer, director, and co-writer and co-producer will be with us as well. My co-host is having problems phoning in. So here live on the show, I'm going to call out to him so he can join us for this interview. Upcoming, we have some great programming coming up this month. Of course, it's October, so it's Halloween time. So we're going to look inside the classic Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock Psycho, and we'll have the author of the Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, which is one of the great books on the making of any film. Here we go. Jerry. Okay. Not working. All right. Let's go ahead and play the interview with Mr. Grudert. Saw 6, of course, comes out Friday, October 23rd. It's just a little over a week away, and here's Kevin telling us all about that and all about his work on the previous Saw films as well. Give me a sense of where your love of movies started, and was the horror genre particularly influential to you?
I've like many of us, I've always loved movies. I've always been a big fan of horror for sure, and we'll never forget the long period of waiting between the book The Shining and the film.
Yeah.
Really.
Oh wow.
Okay.
Cool.
I'm maybe a little bit older than people suspect at times, but I was just a kid, but for sure I was a huge Kubrick and Stephen King fan
mm-hmm.
when I was a kid, and so I snuck into the R-rated The Shining the very first day it came out, and you know, was hooked. So
yeah,
but I like lots of other movies beyond horror as well, and books and that sort of thing. But
right.
Horror has a special place in my heart, absolutely.
And with good reason. These are highly successful movies.
Yeah,
in
that part. I mean, you really
well.
Can't
what's funny
get
is that I had not really worked in horror films before Saw, and
mm-hmm.
and it's not for lack of desire, but simply because when you're getting, it's hard enough to get into this business without being able to select every movie
mm-hmm.
that you get to work on, and so. I started, one of my first jobs was on an Ernest film, Ernest Scared Stupid, which
right,
it was
right.
Halloween themed, and there were evil trolls in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you could say that my first film was horror, but not really.
Right, okay.
Right.
But that being a touchstone movie led to a bunch of other Disney movies. So for a long time I was doing kid fare.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Feeling
yeah.
somewhat out of place. And then when I was working on George of the Jungle 2, I met the producer, Greg Hoffman, and he liked my work as an assistant editor on that and gave me the job of editor on Saw, which at the time was a very small film, not expected really to go beyond direct-to-video, but it got into Sundance, and Lionsgate picked it up, and, you know, the rest is history.
It was a tremendous success, yeah. But before we get into that, I want to ask you about a couple of these projects that you co-edited or acted as an apprentice editor on, assistant editor.
Sure.
And obviously the big one is Titanic.
Yeah. Again, on something like that, I was an assistant editor, so I didn't really have creative input on that. I was mostly working in the visual effects editorial department, and it was an exciting job for sure. And
right.
It was really great seeing that movie come together because... you know, it was like Saw, it was hard to tell what way it was going to go, box office-wise. You know, it did seem like a special movie, for sure, at the time, but incredibly risky for the studio and James Cameron. Obviously, it really paid off. So it did have that kinship with Saw for me, just not having any idea whether it was going to go up or down.
Yeah, but a whole lot more at stake with Titanic.
Yeah, I mean, everything was at stake at that time.
We could make 200 Saws for
that's right.
Titanic.
No, I was thinking maybe even 300, but...
yeah, it could be.
Jerry, you wanted to know about...
No, I have a question about that, but I also wanted to ask a question because, you know, one of the things, the editor is the unsung hero of the movie. The editor is the person who really makes it all come together, regardless of what we may think. It's really there in the cutting room floor and post-production where the magic happens and the magic stays. Now, from this transition from editor to director, what do you bring with you to the set? Were you already thinking about how you're going to do this in post-production, or do you keep that until your post-production?
Well, I think as far as first-time directors go, coming from an editorial background, I probably had a better sense than a lot of directors going in their first time of exactly what kind of shots I would need, particularly since, given our schedule and budget, you can't just shoot everything you could possibly want. You know,
right.
There are some big budget movies that can kind of do that, but you know, really you have to be very economical. And
right.
I think my editing background helped me a lot there to make intelligent choices about what I would and also wouldn't need, you know, what I could get away with, and then when we were really under the gun, time-wise, you know, I'd look at my shot list that had, say, 30 shots on it and say, well, I'm only going to be able to get 10.
Mm-hmm.
What do I need to tell the story and be stylish and, you know, not hate myself in the cutting room?
Right,
so
right.
I think as editor I was able to make those choices fairly well. Again, that's just compared to the average first-time director. And then also I probably shot fewer takes than I thought I would because I'd see what we got and, you know, after two takes often and say, well, you know, I could keep doing this, but if I get five takes of this setup, then that fourth setup at the end of the day is not going to happen at all. So I'd be able to make the call. I can put this scene together with what I've just shot. So let's
right.
So that helped a lot. So I'm editing in my head the whole time. That doesn't mean I know exactly where I'm going to cut everything together, but I'll know what I need to tell the story.
Yeah, that I would imagine that technical expertise you have in your background must help you though when you're doing this, especially a film that is, let's be very honest, where it comes together in the editing more so than a lot of other horror films and a lot of other films in general, just because of the setup and the plot. And let's be honest, Jigsaw is just this insane mastermind. You need to have good editing with this guy as your villain.
Sure, I think from the first Saw film, the editing has played a pretty significant role, just in the look of the movie. You know, not everybody likes the style that we've adopted there, but I think that without it would be kind of bland.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, tell me how you define that style, because obviously you've been an architect of the series from the very beginning.
Right. Well. I think it's a style that bears a graphic design in mind, meaning that the editing is not just putting the pieces together, but putting them together with a lot of flair and very kinetic, and kind of messing with the audience's head. I think by cutting as fast as we do, or you know, making the cutting pattern as quick as it is, especially when we're doing those reveal montages at the end
mm-hmm.
of some of the movies. It has an energy that always, the idea is to make the audience feel like they have to catch up
right.
to comprehend what's going on. And that can be annoying for some, no question. But I think in general, it's effective at making us seem clever when it works. When
well,
it doesn't, it makes us seem like idiots. But
yeah, no, but you've messed with my head between the Saw movies and The Strangers as an editor. You've messed with my head more than enough for one lifetime.
Oh, did you like The Strangers?
I did like The Strangers. I liked the first
good.
Half. The second half, it's not about the editing. It's not about anything like that. But I just think whatever you guys did with the sound department in that film
mm-hmm.
and whatever, you can't do that to someone like me in a midnight show. You really can't do that. There's not enough anti-anxiety medication available on the market. Okay? That is some scary shit, okay?
Yeah. I love The Strangers.
Oh,
I
know
it.
You loved it more than me, but I was still scared. You know, walking out in the parking lot of the movie after that, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, when I first got involved in The Strangers was as we were finishing Saw 3. And I talked to Brian Bertino, the writer-director, on the phone while I was still in Toronto, and he presented it as a film that was going to be a genuine character drama, but that turns into a horror film. And that was very attractive to me, and the rural setting as well made me think, this is something very different than Saw. And when we were working on it, I really put my mind to, how can I do this differently, but still, you know, create something effective. You know, I wanted
mm-hmm.
to stretch my wings, as it were. And with Brian and the producers and the sound department, when we were on the mix stage, we found, because we tested the film a couple of times, and you know the movie got edited quite a bit, we found that the quieter the movie got, the scarier it was. And
oh, that's
less,
very true.
The less we saw the stranger, like originally the strangers had some dialogue throughout the movie. You know, usually it was in the form of taunting Scott and Liv in the house,
mm-hmm.
but we found that once you heard their voices even once, it kind of took away from the sort of inhuman ghostliness of them. So we were
mm-hmm.
constantly paring back, and particularly in the first third of the film, up to the point where Liv pulls the curtain back and the man in the mask is standing there in
mm-hmm.
the sliding glass door, we just kept going quieter and quieter and quieter, and then hit with everything on that moment. And you really felt it. You know,
oh, 20 yeah.
Minutes, 20 minutes of total quiet and, you know, moody, very low-key music, and then bang, just throw the audience into it. I feel it really worked.
It works, yeah.
It does work. There's no doubt about that. I mean,
Now with this Saw, with Saw 6, when you were given, how did the opportunity to direct it come about? Did you campaign for that? Or?
I did. From pretty early on, after Saw 2, Darren Bousman had intended to go on to do something else, and I had talked to him and the producer Greg Hoffman about the possibility of at least being considered to direct one of these things, and he said I should make a short, which I did. He passed away about a week after that, and it was a real tragedy.
Mm.
He was a young guy, 41. And had brought the whole team together and really, really put Saw together, and so it was very terrible when he died. But we got back on our feet. You know, the other remaining producers still wanted to make the Halloween deadline, and Darren said he'd come back, and so he wound up doing 3 and 4, and they wanted me at that point to continue on to edit 5 and 6, and I said, well, I'll edit 5 if you let me direct 6, and they agreed to that, and it was pretty cool. I think David Hackle, the production designer from 2, 3, and 4, made a comparable deal, and that's how he wound up directing Saw 5.
Now, I think the biggest challenge when a series has continued as long as this one has would be, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't thing, because I would think it would be hard to, you want to keep it as fresh as possible, and yet maintain a lot of the same elements that the fans love in the series. Is that a difficult balance to find?
Well, it's really difficult because I think every single Saw fan loves the character Jigsaw. There's no question about that. But he's dead. And so we have a lot of other characters that are continuing on the legacy.
Right.
And the fact is, there's not a single other character that everybody agrees, you know, this person should just take over the franchise and I'll be happy. So we'll never be able to make everybody happy again, and that's kind of heartbreaking because we work really hard on these movies. And
you can't though in this genre, you can't make everyone happy in the horror genre. The horror fans are, you know, and I love them and everything. You can't please all of them at the same time.
It's true. So it's just a percentages game, but like I said, it is kind of heartbreaking because I want everybody to love the movie, and I know that it will divide people. I think they'll like it at least as much as Saw 4 and 5. I mean, I truly believe that, and I think the consensus agrees with me as well. The people that have seen the film internally, so that makes me feel good. But like I said, there's a lot of disagreement amongst both the fans and internally about, you know, what direction we should go or should have gone, and you know what characters we should emphasize, and it's very, very complicated. Let me tell you.
Now, do you keep close tabs on? Well, not close tabs. I don't mean you're stalking them, but do you remain privy to their opinions, the fans, and their takes on the film?
Oh, I do stalk them.
On
the fan forums, absolutely. I've been watching them for years now, and you know, on Official Saw and House of Jigsaw, I've participated quite a bit, at least in the last year. You know, more just keeping people informed of the basics, the things that I can say without spoiling the movie.
Right.
But also getting feedback, and you know, for what it's worth on my end, you know, I don't have total power, obviously, but at least trying to get a sense of what's working, what isn't in the franchise. So I pay a great deal of attention to that.
Right.
And I turned off the setting that lets people know when I'm online at any given time. So I really am stalking.
You are totally Jigsaw now. But I have a question for you, and it's more an observation than a question. How does it feel with, now you have six films, you have scared off on this release date, you've claimed it as, it's no horror film in their right mind wants to go against you. Look, Halloween 2 was released at the end of August. Rob Zombie one was released at the end of August when it came out 2 years ago, or whenever it was. You
right.
guys have really, in a matter of 6 years, and it's not a long time if you think about it, scared every other horror film and franchise in existence.
Well, it is kind of amazing. It feels miraculous to all of us. I mean, we're still scratching our heads. We're just grateful, really, because you know, it's a lot of it was serendipity, and you know, Saw 1 was completed for Sundance in January of 2004.
Right.
And at the time, I was like, get it out there, you know, because it was my first editing job, and I really wanted to get my career going. And they're like, we're thinking like end of October. I'm going, no, put it out there. But they're like, no, this is a smart thing to do. And, you know, guess what? It was. I mean, sooner or later, people, I think Cabin in the Woods was originally going to release on the same date as us, and for, you know, God knows what reason, they moved on. The Box is about a week later. You know,
the Box is 2 weeks later now.
2 weeks later. Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Although they're using the Saw music in the trailer, which I thought was
Yeah, and I know. I saw that the other day, the trailer again. I hadn't seen it in a couple of weeks, and I was like, wait, that's the Saw music. Why are they using that? You guys have moved yourself 2 weeks away. Why are you using the music?
It's kind of bold, huh?
Yeah.
Now you've worked with Richard Kelly, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I worked with him on the director's cut of Donnie Darko. But you know, again, not a particularly creative job, just sort of in the background. But that was fun.
Can I ask
you
an honest question about him? Because I am maybe more so than most who walk this earth a huge fan of his, especially the second film, Southland Tales. Did you notice anything special about him when you worked with him?
Well, he's extremely determined. You know, he obviously has tons of great ideas and a huge amount of talent. I can't say I got to know him personally.
Right.
You know, again, I was in the room with him a fair amount, but it wasn't you know, like a collaboration or anything like that particularly. But no, he's definitely a very sharp guy.
Oh yeah, I mean, you make a movie like that, first of all, just Donnie Darko, but then you make one like Southland Tales. That's a mind working in overdrive.
Yeah, he's out there for sure.
Yeah.
Now, before I let you go, you have to give me a sense as much as you can, because I know it's a very protected property. What can fans expect from this Saw?
Well, we've what would be the best way to characterize it? I think we have some strong new themes that run through the film. We've really, obviously there are going to be flashbacks in it because there are characters that we know are returning that died in earlier Saws. But I've tried really hard not to have the flashbacks just be in there for the sake of themselves. There's a fairly complex plot, although it's a clear story, I think. I don't think anybody will be particularly confused. But at the end of the day, it's a real emotional ride, I think, on the level of the best of the Saw films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very engaging characters and, you know, quite a few different storylines going on at the same time that hopefully interweave in a way that's going to be very satisfying. I think the traps are incredibly intense, and I'm really proud of the traps as well.
Mm-hmm.
as our new characters.
Now these films are so intense to watch. Would we be surprised to see you in the process of making the film? Is it a different tone when you're making the film on the set?
Well, on the set they're pretty fun and funny.
Yeah.
And that's always been the case. You know, I think the more fun we're having, the more engaged the actors get, and that's when it really comes through. So, you know, Tobin's obviously a pretty serious guy, at least when he's working, you know. But someone like Costas, the guy can't stop making jokes, you know. And
that's good. No, that's good to know. I that's really good to hear about these kind of films, because they're so heavy and so, you know, scary. But
well, you know, sometimes you do a scene and it is kind of a darker experience.
Yeah.
You know, particularly when there's death involved, obviously. But,
right.
But a lot of times, you know, you've got prosthetics and fake blood flying around. It's pretty hilarious. You know, and I can't get into details until after you see the movie. But
of course,
you know, it's more fun than horrifying, to be honest.
Now, I read a quote from you prior to your shooting this film, the start date,
the old me,
where you said that it was important for you, I think I'm right about this, to bring a sense of finality to this Saw.
Right. Well, it was and is, and I think we succeeded in that. You know, you've probably heard by now that Saw 7 is in the works,
mm-hmm.
and you know, more power to him for that. But at the same time, it was always meant to be a second trilogy, Saw 4, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'll feel that way, you know, and they don't really have any choice. With Saw 7, they'll be breaking new ground.
Yeah. Isn't that how it should be, though? You should make each one like it's the last one. Yeah, put everything you got into the one you're working on currently.
Well, that's certainly the way I feel, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like cliffhangers, you know. I'll always carry that spark of anger at the ending of The Empire Strikes Back. I was like, I'll never do that to someone as an 8-year-old, you know.
I know what you mean. You had to wait 3 years to find out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and even then it's like, hmm.
You mentioned The Shining, though. So out of curiosity, you being a Kubrick fan and a Stephen King fan, those two are really battling heads when you watch The Shining, because it's such a different experience from the book. So what was your take on the film?
Well, you know, I think I understood that they couldn't do topiary animals. Even if they technically could do it, it probably would have been a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
The hedge maze is just far more cinematic, and
mm-hmm. Right.
You know, some of the people that die and don't die is kind of shocking. You know, when Halloran just gets clobbered right when he walks in the hotel. It's like,
yeah.
But, you
oh,
know,
yeah.
That was really scary, because for readers of the book, you didn't know that was going to happen. So at the end of the day, the camera work and production design came together to really make that film, you know, not to mention the performances. So if Stephen King was mad at Kubrick, which I think he maybe was, he should get over it. it's, there have been some great films made of Stephen King novels, but that's the best.
Kevin, my friend, thanks so much for taking time out with us today.
Thank you, guys.
Good luck.
And thanks a lot for calling me on this.
Okay, Kevin Grudert, the director of Saw 6, which opens in theaters October 23rd. Jerry, you with me now?
I am with you now. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. You're loud and clear, man.
Well, that's good. As long as I'm loud, get clear, but as long as I'm loud, that's all that counts.
Yeah, you're loud.
Yeah, I'm loud.
Yeah, a lot of excitement about this new Saw, well, as there are for all Saw films. Do you remember when that first Saw came out? I remember it because I think James Wan, I think it was, he was associated somehow with near where I live in Orlando, and it was this you know, little independent film from someone that just graduated, I think, and it premiering at Sundance, and it was one of those movies that really people took to at Sundance, and now it's become a whole, you know, industry unto itself, man.
It's a franchise. It's its own industry. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, so we're talking to him about these guys have scared everyone off. Nothing really quite compares to, you know, regardless of what you may think of them, and I'm not its biggest fan, but, you know, they clean up. I wouldn't open my film on the 23rd. I think the movie Amelia Earhart's opening up the same day. Not that that's targeting the same audience. I just wouldn't open anything that day if I really cared about my bank account or my 401k. I really wouldn't. I just like avoid it.
Yeah. You can picture Amelia Earhart. That's how she disappeared, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, Jigsaw got a hold of her, you know? I mean, or Jigsaw's grandfather.
Yeah. So will you be in the theater? What's the last one you went to see in the theater?
I've seen all of them, and I had to see the last two because Will from Horror Yearbook wanted me to review them, but I got to tell you something. I don't know if I can sit through these anymore. They're such downers. I like horror films. I think the funny thing is a lot of people think I don't like horror films. If you looked at the amount of horror I saw in a daily year, you'd be shocked. I mean, really, if you saw what the horror films that I have watched on a yearly basis, you would be shocked. But these, after a while, it gets for me at least, very tiresome. But I'm 39 years old. I've grown up with a lot of this stuff. But after a while, these just sort of become repetitive to me. That's not to say I know they do a job and they have a fan base, and I think that's great. I think that's wonderful.
But that's the main thing. I mean, when you want to continue a series this long, that's why that was the important question, I think, to him was, you know, how do you keep it fresh? Because if you make it too fresh, I mean, if you make it too new, it is no longer a Saw film and it turns fans off.
Oh, yeah. I mean, horror fans, horror fans are very conservative in that way. They do, I don't even, that's not the right word, forgive me. Horror fans, like, they want a certain thing when they come in, and you got to give it to them because they're the ones that are, you know, that are filling your wallet. You don't want to piss them off. That you have to really appease your core constituency, and you don't want to change it that Jigsaw all of a sudden is going to read Shakespeare or something or turn over a new leaf, try to be good or something. You don't want to do that, and we've seen that happen in other franchises over the years. In the last 20 years, do different things, and they've turned off large segments of the population, their core audience. So you don't want to do that. The Saw films are, I'm just waiting for the day when they stop making these, and 20 years after that when they reimagine them.
Yeah, you know that's going to happen, yeah.
That is going to happen. People think I'm joking when I say that, but no, 20 years from now there will be a reimagined version of Saw. I don't doubt that.
Yeah, I think 20 years is a bit too far. I don't think they're going to wait that long.
Wouldn't you think it was going to be 5 years?
I wouldn't doubt it. You know, they was just announced that the people behind Saw are now creating a remounting Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 3D. They're going to be.
Yeah, I saw that. Wow.
Yeah. So
yeah.
I don't know. I did see. I watch a lot of horror too, and I saw two really good horror films this weekend. And they're so rare, good horror films. And I saw the movie that we're going to be talking about in a little bit with the makers, a movie called Forget Me Not, which is honestly very, very much an ingenious movie.
Right.
And I saw The House of the Devil.
That's on demand, right?
It could be. I'm not
yeah, I think it is on our on demand. I want to watch that.
It's great. It's not a it does deliver all the gruesomeness and everything that fans want nowadays. But what's most amazing about the movie is, and we're going to speak to the director in a week or so, it feels like an 80s horror film. And it's not the clothes. It's not it's the film itself. I don't know what the stock that they used, but it feels like it was made in the early 80s. Feels like one of those movies. It's great. For somebody
all
like
right,
that.
No.
Yeah.
I saw a horror film yesterday. And I'm not talking about Couples Retreat either. I saw Paranormal Activity.
Okay, we're going to talk to them next week too for the show.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very effective. Very effective film. I don't know what you've heard about it. It's a lot of hype and everything, but there are some genuine scares. And especially watching in a theater. Sadly, my theater wasn't as packed as the screening before, or as as packed as I would like to have been. But for the people who were there, there are several scenes that are like, jump out of your seat moments. This film has them.
Yeah.
This film definitely has them.
Well, I know it's really in demand, so I've been working with Paramount to try to get talents from the movie on, and it looks like that's going to happen early next week. But what I hear about it is all the comparisons shoot to Blair Witch, except they say that this feels like a lot more of a horrific climax to this film than Blair Witch did.
Well,
it doesn't sound like a movie that people are going to be bitching and moaning about it just being a stunt for some reason.
Well, I didn't feel that about Blair Witch, but I definitely don't feel this about this because they're just like, and what we were talking about with our guest before about the sound on The Strangers. Well, that's definitely, the sound plays a big part in this film. And I would even go far as to say the sound is one of the major stars of the film. But it's also very interesting because you're watching basically what is camcorder footage, like in Cloverfield or Wreck or what have you. And it's very interesting. There are some nice touches to the Amityville Horror because a lot of the really crazy stuff happens at 3:15 in the morning. And if you remember in Amityville Horror, in the original, everything started to happen at 3:15. So it's a very interesting and at times very frightening film.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it. I need to see it. I'll probably be watching it tomorrow night. But they also had their internet campaign where 1 million people voted in favor of having it have a national release. Paramount would release it nationally, and that's what they're doing because it hit 1 million the other night.
Did you see how well it did this weekend? With only like 159 screens, it was number 5.
No kidding.
Yeah, dude, it is cleaned up. I mean, it's the real story of the weekend, if not of the year. I mean, this film is really. Whoever is in Paramount's marketing, this is just brilliant. I mean,
I think the marketing is brilliant. And I tell you what, the trailer for the movie is amazing because you see you just see the audience reaction. That's what the majority of the trailer is. It's shooting the audience watching the movie.
Right.
And that's great. I mean, that's
It is. That is
it's,
what you want.
Made $7.1 million this weekend, up 1,229% from the previous.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing. So that looks like it's going to be a great one. If anyone wants to call in and talk to us about any of these topics, just give us a call at 718-508-9477. And feel free to bring up any topic you'd like.
Anything you want to talk about it.
Yeah. So what else? What else have you...
I love
you know
that.
What
it's like really.
You know what else I was watching? I was watching the ending of that movie Fear. Remember that movie with Mark Wahlberg?
Yeah, I was. I've been thinking a lot about Mark Wahlberg, but it wasn't because of that movie. But yeah.
I don't want to know.
No, because
anyway.
About Boogie Nights and Traveler and We Own the Night. But okay.
So remember that's a Jamie Foley movie. That was his follow-up, I think, to Glengarry.
yeah, quite a follow-up,
And when I'm watching the end of it, everybody descending upon the house, I'm like, you know what this is like? This is like Straw Dogs for Dummies. That's what it was.
Oh, God, here we go with Straw Dogs again.
I just want to share that insight.
No, that's a good insight. But I have to tell you something. I'll stand by what I'm about to say. I think Straw Dogs is an excellent movie. I think it's one of Dustin Hoffman's finest performances, and I think it's an awesome film. All right, I just want to say that because when push came to shove, I was a pussy and didn't stand up for the film when we had Rod Laurie, who I respect a lot, on, and I didn't stand up for the film, and I just want to let that be known right now because that film is fucking awesome.
I mean, I love the movie, too. That's why I said Fear is Straw Dogs for Dummies.
No, I realize that. No, I appreciated that. Dude, God damn it. Some days I think you think I'm Aaron sometimes. But no, I realize that. You're standing up for the film. It is a good film. It is a very controversial film. It was a film that got a lot of bad reviews when it came out. And, of course, Fear got, I think, all bad reviews. But I always hate what they did to that dog in that film.
Also, Neil Marshall and another horror movie news. Neil Marshall and Sam Raimi are working together on a 3D movie.
Yeah, that's what is this about? People who spontaneously combust or something, or
isn't that Scanners?
Yeah, I mean, it could be Scanners. Hey, speaking of Cronenberg, we haven't talked about Cronenberg's latest thing, have we?
Not on this show, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the big news about Cronenberg is, you know, arguably one of his best movies. I mean, even if you're a massive Cronenberg fan or not, you'd have to put it right at the top of his resume, is his remake of The Fly from 1986, Jeff Goldblum. Big news from David Cronenberg is he's announced that he is going to remake his remake of The Fly, which seems to me... you know, a friend of ours, Joel, made a statement that if anybody else did this, I'd be pissed off because The Fly, his version, is a classic movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not upset that Cronenberg's doing it, and I think it speaks to his particular eccentricity and uniqueness that he would do
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's just such a curiosity. You're going to remake a remake. You know, this. It's interesting. I'm curious what he wants to bring to it. I'm very curious. He's a fascinating director, very fascinating gentleman, and
Who would you cast as Seth Brundle?
Jake Gyllenhaal.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you. I would cast Jake Gyllenhaal. It's tailor made for him. You need someone who is a great actor, but also is someone who is great at who can play these quirky, off-the-wall roles. I would put Jake Gyllenhaal in that role in a heartbeat. I'm not just talking about Donnie Darko, but I'm also talking, you need the guy who is in The Good Girl and Lovely and Amazing, but you need the guy who is in Donnie Darko. That's who I would put.
Wow.
And I just made that up on the spot, baby. No pre-thought whatsoever. You told me to pick a name, and I picked... Because what did you think? I was going to pick Danny McBride, who I would put in. That's my second choice.
I can't think of – I mean, I can't picture Jake Gyllenhaal, but it all depends upon the, you know, the, what they come up with. But
okay, B.J. Qualls.
Well, that I could picture that a lot more. I can't picture him being threatening. But, you know, but then again, I was talking – we couldn't necessarily picture Goldblum in that kind of role prior to seeing the original movie either. You want to get that, or?
No. No. I'm on the cell phone. There's someone else can get that. Don't worry. I can't believe that got oh, my God, I ruined our show already.
Right. So, but Jeff Goldblum was amazing in that, and there's actually talk that he might reprise the role in the remake of the remake.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be even more fascinating.
Wow, that would be incredible.
You need somebody that you can believe. I mean, Jeff Goldblum had it all. He had the nerdy quality, the brainy quality. He had the physicality and the athleticism. I mean, you believed each stage that he went through.
I'll give you that. But I was just thinking because the other choices we have are Tobey Maguire, Elijah Wood. I'm just giving you names of people I know that can play really smart, geeky, but also can be leading man. Because you know where we're going to go after all this. You know what the choice I'm going to pick is.
No.
When I've exhausted these three, and you are going to laugh your head off. You and Chris are going to go home, and you're going to say, oh, my God, I think we need to fire him. Jim Carrey.
I would believe Jim Carrey.
Okay.
Because, first of all, Jim Carrey is – Jim Carrey isn't – he does come off as an adult. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you cast one of those other guys you mentioned, which they very well might, then the studio would be kind of, and Cronenberg would be skewing for a younger audience. I don't know that he would do that, you know?
Okay, well, those are just actors of their generation, I thought, because I do think they might be. Now, if Jeff Goldblum is going to come back, that's fine. I think that's perfect. I think Jim Carrey, I'm just going on the work in The Cable Guy and even something as congenial as Yes Man, you know, but he could do that. He could.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be a wild, I would actually think it would be a bold choice for Jim Carrey.
What about Sean Penn?
I just don't see him doing it. If they put
an environmental stamp on it, you know.
I don't even think you need that. I just think, you know, he's just not. I want to see Sean Penn direct another movie. That's what I want to see.
I mean, he's such an awesome director. I can't get enough of him acting. Also, Mission Impossible 4, J.J. Abrams has hinted around that he might get Leonard Nimoy and Peter Graves involved in it.
Wow.
Remember when that original Mission Impossible came out and they interviewed, like, Peter Graves and they were all included in the first scene of Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all killed. They were all killed.
right.
And they said, we don't want that. So, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe they changed their tune.
Maybe. I don't know. I'll be very curious to see how that turns out.
Yeah. Okay, what else? What else have you seen? Because you saw
Paranormal.
Well,
I saw Paranormal, and I saw Couples Retreat, and it's worth talking about because I think it's very distressing. Because I wouldn't even bring up the film, Jamie, but you know who wrote the film? Do you know who wrote it?
Vince Vaughn and John Favreau.
That's very distressing to me. This is the kind of film they would have made. This is the kind of film they used to make fun of. That's what troubles me. This is the kind of film. You would never know watching this film that the guys who wrote Swingers and Maid, who starred in Old School and all these. You can't believe this is what you. I don't know. The first half is actually, you know, kind of interesting, and then it just goes off the rails, but. I'm like, when I saw that they wrote it, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, these guys are so funny. These guys have always been so funny. And lately, these movies, I don't know what it is, but it just seems so formulaic. And I never saw Four Christmases with Vince Vaughn, so I don't know. I can only imagine it's probably along these lines. But it's really not that funny. You would never know these are the guys who made it. And John Favreau, I think, is an excellent director. He didn't direct this. This is actually Peter Billingsley.
Yeah.
I think his directorial debut, but it's just like, it gets to the point where it's so unfunny after a while. I always want to give Vince Vaughn and John Favreau the benefit of the doubt, but it's just not here. It's really just not here. It's very, and I find it very distressing because I think these guys, when I saw Swingers, God, was in 96, I couldn't stop laughing. I just thought this is really good. And Vince Vaughn, definitely for a while there, earned those accolades as like a young Bill Murray, and I still think he has that in him, but I just don't see it in this.
Well, I like Vince Vaughn a lot. I think he's very talented, but I always see him kind of, I hate to say this, but I've seen a trend of him selling out too.
Yeah.
But I did read an interview with him, and he said, yeah, there's room to do all kinds of different stuff, because he started out doing a lot of dramatic work as well.
Speaking of
remakes, I mean, he was in the remake of Psycho, but...
Yeah, no, and he was in a great dramatic role a couple of years ago, a small indie film that I like a lot, the Thumbsucker, which he was really good in, and, I mean, I loved him in another film.
He was great in The Prime Gig, which is the other indie film.
But... Yeah, that, and Clay Pigeons he was very good in, and of course, the two of them, when Aaron made a couple, like back in 2001, I couldn't stop laughing during that. And I just think they have. It's just weird to see them doing these films. It's like also like Fred Claus. You know, it's like I know you have to do the things to the family. You have to branch out and everything. I'm not saying that everything has to be Swingers, but it's just so odd to see them do some of these films. Like, you know, a couple of years ago, you guys were making fun of people for making these films.
Yeah.
But that's just me. I love. I'll go see Vince Vaughn in anything. So and John Favreau, obviously Iron Man. What he's done. I love what he did with Elf. And things like that, so I can't, you know, I'm just saying, it was just so, I didn't realize they had written it, so that really kind of floored me.
Yeah, and I don't know. I see it as a movie that's a product more than anything. I mean, I see it as like this is something that can appeal to the ladies as much as the men, and let's build it with that in mind to kind of get the feel going. And it did. The reason why it grossed $10 million more than they predicted was because women flocked to it as well. It made
Got a great cast. You can't complain with that. And a lot of people say the whole thing is stupid. I think the first half of the movie, I think before they get to the island, the film has a lot of promise. And then when you get to the island, it just really doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I bet. So you saw those three movies this weekend. Wow. And well, I just saw
Paranormal Activity, Couples Retreat. What else did I say I saw? Because what, you got a camera at this house or something? Do you have, surveillance equipment up here?
Oh, I thought you said you saw one more. I just saw the two horror movies here at home.
No, but those are good. I wish I had seen those two horror movies. Really wish I saw those two horror movies.
Yeah.
But...
You remember last time we talked about Saw, we had on the star of Lyric Bent, who was the star of Saw 4.
Yes, that's true.
And we had a good live turnout for that one as well.
We did.
That same show, we paid tribute to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original. And this is fascinating because all the interview requests I sent out for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, there's one cast member that has never spoken about it. She's kind of lived her life and she's refused all requests and stuff. And she's affectionately known as the Meat Hook Girl.
Right.
Terry McMinn is her name. And now she's just come out and she started doing conventions and stuff and she started to talk about it. So she said, you know, I was living my life. I had a job outside of the entertainment field and, you know, but now she's back in the fold. And I think TCM fans are really, as I am one, are really rejoicing about that. Because it's been a voice that's been lacking these past few years.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, as far as that goes. Now, this month we do have a lot of horror-related materials. We're looking back on the making of Psycho this month as part of our Inside the Classic series. We have the author of Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, Mr. Stephen Rebello. We also will be... talking about Paranormal Activity and the House of the Devil and various other projects. And we also have, we're lining up cinematographer Vilma Zsigmond, who shot so many movies. McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He just got done shooting the new Woody Allen movie. He just got back from that. They have an exciting documentary out for anybody that loves movies about him. And his friendship with another great cinematographer, Laszlo Kovacs.
Mm-hmm.
Kovacs, yeah. So some great material coming up, and we'll be talking about Robert Altman next week. And on this show, in a few minutes, we'll be bringing on the creators of the new horror film Forget Me Not, which premieres at this year's Screamfest LA. It's a big premiere that I'm sure they're thrilled about. And we're going to end the show on our movie song of the week, which is horror-related.
Oh, my God.
Remember...
I know, I'm acting generally surprised. Come on, dude, don't give me that dead silence. I mean,
when you have a pop song from a horror film, and I think this was the 80s. They're bound to be kind of campy. So it's been a while since I've heard the song, and I downloaded it for tonight's show. I think people will get a kick out of it. But who knows? You
know,
remember
I know,
what last? Remember what last week's song was?
No, I don't remember what last week's song. It was too long ago. My mind has gone to waste. It's rotted. So tell me, please. Tell us all.
Yeah, we didn't have a movie song last week. Last week was...
Well, see, that's why I forgot. I mean, come on. I mean, you can't play trick questions like that on me. I mean, you know, that's what I told the guy, you know, our first guest. You can't do that to me. There's not enough anti-anxiety medicine out there, okay? Come on.
The week before that was Paula Cole, Feeling Love from City of Angels. But last Sunday we had... our two-hour Polanski retrospective, and we had a great response from that. Guests like Brett Ratner were joining us for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the latest news on Polanski is that his argument to be freed and under house arrest in Switzerland was denied.
Mm-hmm.
And so it looks like the extradition process, which I didn't realize could take months, is still happening. And somebody visited him and was interviewed, I think a friend or collaborator of his, and just said that he was depressed. So
I could imagine that. I mean, yeah, I saw that earlier. Yeah, I mean, of course he'd be depressed.
Anyway, so that's what's going on the Polanski front. Greatest horror films, man. What if you were to make a list of your three top favorite horror films, what would they be?
Oh my God, you really love to do this to me. The Omen, The Exorcist, Rosemary's Baby, but that's what I would have said like 15, 20 years ago, but I have to throw in The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the original Dawn of the Dead 2. So those would be my top five.
Yeah. It's interesting how The Shining's not in there.
Well, no, I love The Shining, but The Shining's more like autobiographical for me than anything else. I don't really consider it a horror film. It's more like, you know, a home movie almost. Don't you see, Jamie? That's what I try to do every week. Just I want to make the people laugh. I want to give them a good laugh. But no, The Shining is. I know. You know. Look, I love The Shining. I used to wear a T-shirt in high school from that. You know, the famous scene where he, you know, uses the axe and everything. I used to wear that like once a week. I had a T-shirt for The Shining. This was like 20 years ago.
Right.
Oh, God, 25 years ago, actually. God, I'm an old fucker. 25 years ago. I do love The Shining. But, you know, I mentioned all those films, and you know what? There's an important film I'm not mentioning. A really important film. And I think you know what it is.
No.
I think our audience knows what it is. And I'm going to name it. Carrie.
Yes.
Carrie is probably, I watched that a couple times after high school, and I watched it after college, and it would always show up on Encore and American Movie Classics. That's when American Movie Classics actually earned its name. And that's just such a brilliant, wicked film. It really is. I mean, there's just so many in-jokes in that, and William Catt's never been better.
That, to me, is like the great Stephen King adaptation.
It is. It really is.
Yeah.
But
I feel the same way.
When we talk about these classic films, but there's a recent film I think definitely deserves a couple recent films that deserve to be on there. The Mist, I think, deserves to be on there. I think The Descent deserves to be on there. I mean, these are some recent films that I think are really good. I think the first two, The Sixth Sense, I do like M. Night Shyamalan. I think the first three films are my favorites, but I mean, The Sixth Sense definitely deserves to be a great horror film. But there are a lot
Let the Right One In.
Oh, Let the Right One In. I think Let the Right One In, as time goes on, the more people see it, you know, it really is a brilliant film, and it's just a shame that they're going to remake it, because not that I have a you know, I understand that they want to cash in on it, but they really should just spend a lot of money and just give the original film a wide release. Beautiful film. Such a
it is.
Beautiful
and, you know,
film.
It was hysterical was when I asked the director, do you have anything to do with the remake? And he said, no. that ended that right away. I guess maybe he didn't have anything to do with the rights to the film. I mean, even if he did, I doubt if they bought it from him, they'd have his involvement because they're disrespectful enough to make it. We have a call from your neck of the woods, man, Maryland. 301 area code.
Hello?
Hi,
hello?
301.
Oh, yeah, I want to say something about what I think is one of the greatest horror movies.
Please, man.
It was a recent film that came out this summer, The Orphan. I love that movie. I really think it brought a new element to the table. I really think it was cool.
I miss that. Did you see that, Jerry? Orphan?
Yeah, I saw that. I agree with it. It is definitely it's a very interesting film, like kind of a variation on The Bad Seed and The Omen and Joshua. And I got to give it, I did not catch the twist coming, that would be what it was. I had no idea. I was in the dark about that. So I thought that was, you know, that was perfect.
Yes, I love the twist. It was really excellent, and I thought it ended kind of badly, distasteful. Like like it was a scene from The Ring 2. I didn't like that, but it throughout the entire movie, it was like jump scares. You know, look through the mirror, nobody's there. Look back, somebody's there. It was.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
you didn't tell me that.
I said I went in charge.
All right, man. Well, thank you. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Buddy. Thank you for calling.
And he's gone. Here's a list of the 100 greatest horror movies, and I'm not going to go through all 100.
No, I would hope not.
I'll go through the top 10. Above is The Mask of Satan, a.k.a. Black Sunday.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Is number 10. Halloween, right. Number 9.
Oh, yeah, that's another one that you can't, you know, the original, you can't forget that. That's so important.
Dreyer's Vampire, number 8.
Ooh, yeah.
I just watched the remastered Criterion of that a few months ago, and it was it was fine.
Yeah.
The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Oh, that's a great one.
The Exorcist, number 6. Number 5, Jaws.
Really? Do we consider Jaws a horror movie?
I tell you what, every horror list I see, Jaws is on there. Anything that scares you, yeah, it's a horror movie. I guess.
Well, I just consider it an American classic, but okay.
Yeah, well, the best horror movies, you know, work outside of the horror genre as well.
Right, right,
there's
yeah.
Universality to them. Number 4, Peeping Tom, Michael Powell.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great, brave choice right there. Number 3, mm-hmm. Night of the Living Dead, Romero,
mm-hmm.
Which I cannot seem to get on this show.
He hates me. It's me. If you fired me, he'd be on the show immediately.
I do blame you for it. And number 2 is Murnau's Nosferatu.
Oh, yeah, man, yeah.
Now, would you put, like, the 1922 Nosferatu above the Herzog Nosferatu?
Yeah, I would, only because that's the one I saw first, ironically. And they're both very good. You can't go wrong with Herzog and Kinski in anything, but
right.
It's just that's the one that really started it all. That version, that you know, that there's a that movie is really responsible for everything. I'm not saying that the Herzog version is brilliant, as is most things that Herzog does. And when he worked with Kinski, you know, it's a shame that we can't have both of them on the show. Look, I would give my life if you could interview Kinski on the show, okay? Because that would be the greatest interview we've ever done. It would be insane.
Is he still with us?
No, he's dead. He's been dead a while.
Well, how the hell am I going to get him on the show?
Well, I was talking about using black magic, satanic rituals. Dude,
well,
would you put
the two Nosferatus above, this is a silly question, above Salem's Lot?
The miniseries that came on in the late 70s? No, but I do like that miniseries, but I would not.
You would put...
No, I would not put... I would put them above Salem's Lot, yes, but...
Yes.
Why? Is Salem's Lot the number one?
No. It was just... It used Nosferatu for inspiration for the main vampire.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And number one is Hitchcock's Psycho.
Wow, no, that's a good. That's you know that you can't go wrong with that.
You can't argue against the influence of Psycho.
No, but, you can't.
Others like past the Texas Chainsaw is number 11. That would definitely be much higher on mine.
Mm-hmm.
They got a lot of Mario Bava, like Blood and Black Lace, Alien, The Shining,
mm-hmm.
Don't Look Now, Dawn of the Dead, Rosemary's Baby. We get Argento, Suspiria, Bride of Frankenstein, James Whale, Evil Dead 2, followed by Evil Dead. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Evil Dead 2 is the general consensus is that that's a superior sequel to the original.
Yeah, it is. That is definitely the consensus.
Fascinating. And then Frankenstein, James Whale. The Thing from John Carpenter, great movie. Carrie figures in at number 24 on this list, followed by The Wicker Man. Now, we're talking about the original Wicker Man, not the remake.
Okay.
That's horrific for a whole new set of...
that movie just blew chunks, but the original is quite frightening, actually. Very chilling film.
American Werewolf in London, Eyes Without a Face, Nightmare on Elm Street. Now, do you think looking in, this is odd, do you think looking at Wes Craven's resume,
mm-hmm.
I know Nightmare on Elm Street coupled with Scream are his two most successful, but would you say that that's the best horror movie that he's made, Nightmare on Elm Street?
No, not by a long shot. It's the Hills Have Eyes, the original Hills Have Eyes is by far the scariest.
The Hills Have
thing.
Eyes, yeah. Yeah.
His version is frightening.
I would put that in Last House on the Left as totally more more disturbing than A Nightmare on Elm Street. Even though, you know, A Nightmare on Elm Street had it played its gimmick very well. I mean,
it did a great job of that, but I just think The Hills Have Eyes I watched it with my family. This was in my junior year of high school, I guess. This is 1987. And we watched that, and then the Monday, they all went up to New York for the day. I went to I had to go to school, and I came home. I was freaked out, you know, because I was the only one home.
It's a disturbing movie. And they have aliens on this list. Now, Aliens, I would argue, is an action film. You know, it really strays from Ridley Scott's Alien in that it's...
Yeah, it does, and I need to add something onto that. Well, I think the first Alien is very frightening. The second one isn't, because you have all those Marines. They're there to ease the tension. You got all these guys, you know, they're ready to fight, and, you know, they're killing the aliens and everything. That made me feel so good watching that in the theater. You know, cool, we got all these guys here, you know, they're going to help us out, because they weren't there in the first one. It was, you know, that was just, that's still, the first one is still very scary.
Yeah, the first one is an amazing accomplishment. Are you ready to bring on our next guest? Even if you're not, I'm going to go ahead and do it.
No, I am. I am very ready, because I want to talk to them, because they sound like really cool people, so I definitely want to talk to them.
Forget Me Not is a terrific new horror film that's a true rarity of the genre in that it's intelligent, it's original, and it's character-driven. Imagine that, Jerry. We don't get enough of those. The film celebrates its world premiere at this year's Scream Fest LA event on Thursday, October 22nd at 7 p.m. And we're pleased to welcome to the show co-producer, co-writer, and director Tyler Oliver and co-producer and co-writer Jameson Stern. I'm bringing them up. Tyler, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Hi, Tyler. Jameson, are you with us?
I believe so.
Now, is it Jameson or Jamieson?
It's Jameson, but Jamie's fine.
Okay, well, my name is Jamie, too. Already we have so much in common. This is
right there.
I loved your movie.
Off to a good start.
I loved your movie, guys. I really, really did. And I'm curious how you two hooked up. Did you guys, Tyler, meet at USC?
No, actually, we had mutual friends. We had known each other over the years and ran into each other, and then I wound up DPing a film that Jamie wrote and played the lead in, and we were on location in New Mexico for a while and just got to talking and, you know, found out we had similar likes, similar interests, and we actually started off giving each other notes on our individual scripts, and I think we were both like, wow, these are some of the best notes we've had. Let's do something together. Mm. So, you know, that's really where it started.
Well, let's talk about some of those similar likes and the movies and the filmmakers that inspired you both. Jamie, if you want to start out with that, who inspired you?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it wasn't really horror films that got me into the business, although I'm now a convert. But I was just listening to your previous conversation, and, you know, a movie like Jaws was very important to me. I grew up on a beach, and so threw me quite a bit, but you know, movies like, you know, the Natural was big for me, and some of the you know, obviously Star Wars, and just, you know, mm-hmm. really kind of big studio films that allowed the imagination to run wild.
Yeah, and how about you, Tyler?
Well, you know, I some of the films that really inspire me are things like Jacob's Ladder. That's a great film. Yeah, and I just love the way it made you think, as well as, you know, scaring the crap out of you.
Yeah,
big time. And the characters are so well developed in that film, and I think that's one of the big common grounds that Jamie and I have, is just that I think what makes these films scarier is when the characters are real and you believe it and mm-hmm. you can relate to them, and they're not, you know, the films that lose me are when it's just all about the scares and mechanics, and you don't really care about who's, you know, who do we care about surviving, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. And I know that you guys really set out to make this film stand out amongst other similar genre films, but what are some of those traps that you guys wanted to avoid, Tyler, that are usually associated with films of this like?
Well, let's see. No cell phones that don't work.
That's true.
No reception. Yeah, we wanted to avoid that. But no, we really, I think, wanted to just concentrate on, you know, we wanted to deliver the scares, have creatures that freak you out, and have those genre moments that you really want when you see a film like this. But more than that, we wanted to, you know, bring it up a level. You know, we wanted to, you know, like we were talking about characters, we wanted a plot that made you think. I don't think either of us wanted to have kids trapped in a cabin in the forest getting slashed, you know. We wanted, we wanted something that was more psychological.
Right.
And also the you know, the horror film audience is so savvy, and they, you know, they don't suffer fools lightly, and so we never wanted to be in a position where the audience was too far ahead of the characters, just because it's an insult to the audience.
Right.
Yeah, and I didn't feel that way at all watching your movie. I was thoroughly engrossed in it. It was such an original kind of premise, and I'm wondering. First of all, Tyler, if you can, and then Jamie, I want to ask you how you came to it. But Tyler, if you could tell our audience a little bit about the premise of the film.
Well, you know, the main premise that we were coming from thematically was just we all have people we've forgotten in the past. You know, kids can be so cruel at that age, and you know, we have these people that just fell by the wayside. What happened to them? And so I think we wanted to build on that and, you know, have the idea of, okay, what if these things you forgot, you know, came back and didn't let you forget, made you atone for your sins in a way. And so that's really what we wanted to build on. And then from there, you know, our core premise was this game, this childhood game that actually Jamie played. And Jamie, I don't know if you want to talk about that, but it was...
Sure. Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, there was a game that I used to play, which it's sort of a regional game. Some people have heard of it, some have not, which was called Ghost in the Graveyard. It's sort of I know that it's played prominently in New England and some people in the Midwest, but have heard of it. But some other areas of the country, they have other things, kick the can or what you will. And it terrified me when I was a kid, while I had a great time playing the game. And so I always thought the basic premise of the game is, you know, kids gather in a graveyard and, you know, they basically play hide and seek. But it was very frightening due to the setting and just the way the imagination runs wild when you're of that age. I just always thought that it would be an interesting premise for a film, probably a horror film. And so Tyler and I were looking for something to do together, and we were just knocking around ideas. And I don't think we knew at the time that we were going to do a horror film. We just knew that we wanted to do a cool idea, something that we hadn't seen. And so I sort of explained this game to him, and then we ended up reinventing the game, taking the sort of the tenets that were frightening and then really making them more specific and allowing elements of the game to end up manifesting itself throughout the plot of the film. Is that pretty clear, Ty, from your perspective?
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, the question became, okay, how do you build what we wanted to do, a smart plot that operated on both a visceral level and also on that psychological level? Okay, how do we expand the premise of this game into a larger world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because particularly when you're dealing with these types of audiences, there's usually one or two different types of films. They either are, you know, a physical threat, or it can be a psychological threat. And, you know, they operate in different ways. And I think we both believed that if we could find a way to have elements of both, that while one takes you on your thrill ride throughout the movie, the other stays with you when you've left the theater. And if we could have both, we knew that we would be onto something good.
And you really are with this film. And part of what fascinates me about you guys, it always interests me in the collaboration, writing the screenplay. How did that work? What were the mechanics of that? How do you collaborate with someone on a screenplay?
Well, you know, it was interesting because I've tried to write with people before, and I emphasize the word try, and it's very difficult to get that productive relationship going. And with Jamie and myself, I mean, it was really like a game of scramble golf, where we would just divide and conquer, and we would write sections individually, and you know what worked, we kept. And I don't think either of us, you know, I think we were blessed in our relationship not having ego attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really have any, there were no battles of, oh, this was my idea, I want it in there. You know, it was really more about, okay, what works and what doesn't, and, you know, hone in on that. And so for me, it was an incredibly productive relationship. I mean, it was, you know, we worked fast, and, you know, it was fun. You know, it kept the excitement of the film going, which was, you know, one of the challenges when you're writing is to keep that excitement up and keep it fresh. And I think we really were able to do that well.
Yeah. I knew you two had to definitely be compatible to be able to go through this process together, because writing alone by yourself is agonizing enough. I can't imagine doing it with someone
else. Yeah, I know.
Well, it wasn't, you know, all writing does have its agony involved, you know. I mean, but...
yes,
you know,
it does.
But if the agony is shared, then you can get through it. So,
absolutely.
And I think
that's a good point.
I think that comes from just really making sure that you agree up front what you're trying to achieve. And like Tyler said, I mean, to really have faith that the other person is also trying to make the best movie possible. And I know that that's much easier, I think, for people to say than to do. And to be able to say, all right, look, you know, I know that you know, like when I would present an idea, you know, I had to be trustful that if Tyler was saying it wasn't right, that it was because, you know, he was right and we were trying to make the same movie. And I had to be able to shoot the same idea down myself and have Tyler advocate for it. And I really think when people are able to exchange that way, where it's like once the idea is presented, it does belong to the project, no longer to the person who presents it, then you can actually collaborate.
We talked about cliches to avoid and that sort of thing, and in this particular genre, and you do have, it is a cast of young people,
yeah.
As is the case with a lot of these types of movies. But these are really well defined characters in this one, and I understand that you went through something like 1,500 actors in the auditioning process for this.
Yeah, it was it was quite a process. You know, it was interesting. We tortured not one but two casting directors throughout this this process. Because they would bring us in, you know, 100 kids, and we'd look at them, and there are a lot of, you know, look at LA, there are a lot of great-looking kids. But
well, it's the master race on parade. I mean,
exactly. Right.
I don't mean that in a bad. I don't mean that as cynical as it sounds. But yeah, that's what it
they're,
is.
They're though. All they're all beautiful there. Yes.
Yeah, they're all just.
Yeah,
well,
so
especially, you know, especially in this age range, you really haven't, you know, when you get a little older in your 20s and 30s, by that point, the town is weeded out a lot of potential. And when you're younger, you know, it's just the pool's a lot larger. And so we really did have to kiss a lot of frogs. I mean, it was amazing. it went on for months and months and months. And the thing is, the one thing that Jamie and I both agreed on is that, you know, you talk about cliches, the last thing we wanted was bad performances in this film or, well, you know, ill-defined characters. So we were
we were
just relentless in the casting, and I'm sure we drove everyone insane. But it was, I think, in the end, worth the effort, because I think our cast just delivered brilliantly. I mean, I think they were.
Yeah, we're very proud of the cast. And one of the things that we impressed upon each other throughout that process, and then upon the cast once we hired them, was that that the acting that is required for horror films in some ways is even more demanding than the acting that is required of other genres, because the stakes are always life and death, and there's a reality that they must achieve, because if they don't believe it, the audience doesn't believe it. And
that's
amazing,
true.
It's amazing how often it's just something that they don't get to for some reason. Now, another thing that was interesting with that was that we did see a ton of kids, but we did see a lot of talented kids too. But it was really about creating an ensemble and really trying to make sure that, as you said, you know, that the characters were distinct and that they worked together in concert, and you believe that these kids had all been friends for since they were children. And, you know, with groups, they all fall in. It's like we you know, one person's strengths are another person's weaknesses, and you know, they play off of one another in a way that is finely honed and has it can only be achieved over time. And so it wasn't we couldn't have anybody that were playing the same that was playing the same notes, you know, and we needed to make sure that one person's characteristics helped define the characteristics of another.
That's absolutely the case, and those were the two points that I was going to make. Anytime we have an actor on the show that has performed in a horror film, I always marvel at it because their performances have to be at such a fever pitch for such a large majority of their screen time. It's gotta be a real endurance test for them. Just because you have the perfect actor in an individual role doesn't mean that they're going to be perfect together, collectively.
Exactly.
Did you have them spend time together, getting to know you time before the shooting?
We did, actually. You know, and these films are always limited with time and resources, but, you know, we really made an effort to get them together as soon as possible. And, you know, we did things like we actually organized a day for them to hang out at the beach, you know, as friends. And we, you know, of course, used that time to shoot you know, snapshots that we use in the film, but it was, you know, it gave them a chance to really get to know each other, and they really clicked. I mean, a lot of really good friendships actually came out of the film, and I'd say at this point they really are a group of friends, which, you know, by the time we were shooting was fantastic because there was an ease that people have when they're friends, and they had that.
Yeah. I would think that it would be pretty frightening when you're shooting the movie and trying to gauge whether or not it's effective. How do you gauge whether or not it's scary, whether or not it's working? How do you know?
If we laugh before we saw it.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is something that the crew had to get used to, but I'd be behind the monitor and I'd just start cackling. And someone's like, what's wrong with this guy? What's happening? Is it terrible? Is it laughable? And I just had to announce to everyone, no, if I'm cackling, things are good.
Yeah.
And so once they got used to that, I think they, you know, they settled in and they could gauge what they were doing.
Well, yeah, when you write these things, like when Tyler and I were working on this script, you know, forever ago, and we would write a scene that we hoped would be terrifying, and then we would live it at that point, and then here we would be, you know, much further down the road, and if we would see it, and it would strike the right chord within us that we knew that we had achieved what we had set out to achieve so long ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. That makes sense.
Well, you know, in these types of films too, you know, when you're shooting, you know, say, you know, we have a couple scenes that are a little graphic, and you've got a bloodbath going on, I mean, you really do get desensitized to it,
right.
Which is where I think what Jamie was getting at, you get back to the core, and it's about, again, it's about character, it's about the story, and those are your guideposts, and then you just have to trust that you have the right, you know, lighthouses along the way to guide you.
Yeah, I know that independent filmmaking is a big battle to begin with, but you guys obviously have shepherded this project from the very conception, and you've worn a lot of hats in getting the project to fruition. And Tyler, I know that I read on your blog you wrote, I wouldn't recommend producing and directing at the same time ever. So explain that to me.
Oh yeah, that's a fun one. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, Jamie and I were, you know, the core forces driving this thing from day one. And, you know, the tough thing, obviously, is, you know, producing and directing, they're two completely different hats, and it's two different sides of the brain. And so for me, you know, when we were in the thick of it, you know, my team tried to protect me as well as they could. You know, but there were moments where I got a text message at 4 in the morning saying a drunk driver hit our set at 90 miles an hour and destroyed all our trailers, generators, and honey wagons.
Oh,
and,
God.
So those were some interesting moments. But, yeah, it's just, for me, it's really, when I'm directing, it's such a specific zone that your brain gets in. That switching back and forth to suddenly worrying about logistics, whether we're going to be able to shoot at this location and what are our options about, you know, finding something else, it suddenly takes you out of that. So I managed to do it, but, yeah, I wouldn't recommend it.
but while you wouldn't recommend it, while you wouldn't recommend it, though, for let's say you didn't have, you know, an amazing partner or anything like that, don't you sometimes feel that you have to wear that hat as well to make sure you get what you want?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the thing, and that's why I did it. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, you have to, with a project like this, you're fighting the forces of nature, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, on all fronts. And so, I mean, you're absolutely right. If I wasn't involved like that, and Jamie as well, you know, who knows what, you know, people make decisions, and they're not informed by the creative. And
right.
I think the movie suffers for that.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
know, and one thing also that I always had faith in having Tyler as my partner in this project was we always knew that we both, that no one cared, was going to care about the movie as much as we did. It didn't
right.
mean as much, you know, they didn't have the emotional ties to it. They didn't have the psychological scars from bringing it through the entire process. But I knew that Tyler did, and so whenever times got tough, you know, sometimes there would be suggestions that were made by other parties that, exactly as Tyler just explained, did not serve the long-term interests of the film, which
right.
you know, which go beyond finishing your day, but to does the film hold up at the end of the day? You know, does it hold together? Does it serve the creative? And despite the difficulties that we had from a producerial standpoint throughout the process, I feel very proud that we never sacrificed on that. And we always, sometimes it made the going tough, but at the end of the day, the choices that we made served the telling of the story.
Yeah, but I tell you another thing that you have to be excited and proud about as well is, I mean, this world premiere, it's going to world premiere Screenfest LA October 22nd at Mann's Chinese Theater, if I'm not mistaken. Jamie, how does that make you feel?
It's fantastic. It's really exciting. But also at the same time for us, there's relief. You know, we always believed we were making a good project, and we're just really happy to be able to share it with people at this point and to get it out there and let the masses see it, and hopefully, it won't end with Screamfest, and it will, springboard into a wider release that people
yeah.
can
support right.
the movie, enjoy it.
Yeah, Tyler, are you nervous or anxious or excited? How are you feeling about the premiere?
I'm just excited. I think Jamie was touching on it. There's something about when you work on a project for this long. And you have so much invested in it, and really, at the end of the day, why do we do this? Well, it's to share what we do with as many people as possible and touch as many people as possible. So I'm just excited it's getting out in the world at this point. You know
yeah.
that we can do that, we can share it, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, I love the movie, and we're gonna keep talking it up leading up to the October 22nd premiere. Here on the show, and please keep us posted on how it advances, if it gets picked up for distribution, where our audience can find it if they're not in the LA area on the 22nd. We'd love to hear back from you guys.
Well, definitely. I will definitely keep you in the loop and really appreciate you supporting a project like that. That's fantastic.
Well, thank you for being on. Thank you.
Thank you, Tyler and Jamie. I appreciate it very much.
Take care. Good luck.
Okay, the movie is Forget Me Not, October 22nd at 7 p.m. at Screamfest LA, world premiere, Mann's Chinese Theater. That's not bad, Mann's Chinese Theater.
No, that's not bad at all. I mean, you couldn't do any better. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah. We have a couple of calls that just popped up out of the blue.
Why don't we take them? Let's take them. Come on, let's take them.
And then we'll
Come
get
on.
To our movie. Then we'll get to our October-themed movie song of the week. We have an 815 area code.
Hey, this is Jim from Chicago, Illinois.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, just wanted to know, did the Saw director leave, or is he still on, or what?
You can replay the interview. He was the first half hour of the show.
Okay.
So at about a half an hour, this show will be available for replay.
Cool. Okay, right. I will do that.
Thank you, buddy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, man. 630 area code. Are you there, 630? Gone. Gone.
Gone. Going, gone.
Man, the Saw film, man, a lot of anxious people. You can hear the interview on replay about the top of the hour. It should be available to you. Or join us on Facebook. Look us up on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll put a link on
it. Or MySpace. We're still on MySpace, too. We are still there.
We're there, yeah. Okay.
Like every...
Any guesses as to what the song of the week might be?
The theme from The Omen? No, I have no idea.
Well, that's a good guess.
That was a good guess.
That's been something, though. I've been thinking, should I do, like, scores? Or I think I'm keeping it the music, the pop music.
Keep it pop music. Yeah, music. Good way to go.
Because we talk about scores a lot. We're actually going to have the composer of The Surrogates, and he's been Jonathan Mastow's composer all throughout his career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we might have a show on Wednesday allowing for him and for the Paranormal Activity talents. And if not, then we'll be back on Sunday with our Robert Altman conversation.
Well, that'll be very interesting. Either both of those shows, so yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you gotta listen to both shows. I mean, if you're a movie.
Yeah, don't just say, oh, I want to listen to Sunday show. No, you want to listen to the Wednesday show too. Basically, if we're all on, you want to be listening to it.
So, I mean, the horror movie that everybody's talking about outside of Saw 6, of course, is Paranormal Activity. And look
mm-hmm.
for us Wednesday night, where we'll possibly have the writer-director of that film on with us. Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. And if you have any questions for that gentleman, you can email them to us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. And also check out our website, moviegeeksunited.net. It's updated all the time.
All the time. Everything you want to know.
Okay. Here's
Let's
our movie song
Saw.
Of the week. You ready, Jerry?
Mm-hmm.
I'm
ready.
This is a camp classic. Here you go.
Okay.
Good night, everybody. See you soon.
Good night. He's the